Meantime, Ahab, out of hearing of his officers, having sighted the furthest to windward, was still ranging ahead of the other boats, a circumstance bespeaking how potent a crew was pulling him. Those tiger-yellow creatures of his seemed all steel and whalebone. Like five trip-hammers, they rose and fell with regular strokes of strength, which periodically started the boat along the water like a horizontal burst boiler out of a Mississippi steamer. As for Fadella, who was seen pulling the harpooner's oar, he had thrown aside his black jacket and displayed his naked chest with the whole part of his body above the gunwale, clearly cut against the alternating depressions of the watery horizon. While at the other end of the boat, Ahab, with one arm, like a fencer's, thrown half backward into the air, as if to counterbalance any tendency to trip. Ahab was seen steadily managing his steering oar, as in a thousand boat lowerings ere the white whale had torn him. All at once the outstretched arm gave a peculiar motion and then remained fixed, while the boat's five oars were seen simultaneously peaked. Boat and crew sat motionless on the sea. Instantly the three spread boats in the rear paused in their way. The whales had irregularly settled bodily down into the blue, thus giving no distantly discernible token of the movement, though from his closer vicinity Ahab had observed it.
"Every man look out along his oars!" cried Starbuck. "Thou, Queequeg, stand up!"
Nimbly springing up on the triangular raised box in the bow, the savage stood erect there, and with intensely eager eyes gazed off toward the spot where the chase had last been descried. Likewise upon the extreme stern of the boat, where it was also triangularly platformed level with the gunwale, Starbuck himself was seen coolly and adroitly balancing himself to the jerking tossings of his chip of a craft, and silently eyeing the vast blue eye of the sea. The whales might have made one of their regular soundings, not a temporary dive from mere fright, and if that were the case, Stubb, as is wont in such cases, it seems, was resolved to solace the languishing interval with his pipe. He withdrew it from his hatband, where he always wore it aslant like a feather. He loaded it and rammed home the loading with his thumb end. But hardly had he ignited his match across the rough sandpaper of his hand when Tashtego, his harpooner, whose eyes had been setting to windward like two fixed stars, suddenly dropped like light from his erect attitude to his seat, crying out in a quick frenzy of hurry,
"Down, down all, and give way! There they are!"
The air around suddenly vibrated and tingled, as it were, like the air over intensely heated plates of iron. Beneath this atmospheric waving and curling, and partially beneath a thin layer of water also, the whales were swimming. Seen in advance of all the other indications, the puffs of vapor they spouted seemed their forerunning couriers and detached flying outriders. All four boats were now in keen pursuit of that one spot of troubled water and air. But it bade far to outstrip them. It flew on and on as a mass of interblending bubbles borne down a rapid stream from the hills.
"Pull, pull, my good boys!" said Starbuck in the lowest possible but intensest concentrated whisper to his men,
while a sharp, fixed glance from his eyes darted straight ahead of the bow, almost seemed as two visible needles in two unerring binnacle compasses. It was a sight full of quick wonder and awe. The vast swells of the omnipotent sea, the surging, hollow roar they made, as they rolled along the eight gunwales like gigantic bowls in a boundless bowling green, the brief suspended agony of the boat, as it would tip for an instant on the knife-like edge of the sharper waves, that almost seemed threatening to cut it in two, the sudden profound dip into the watery glens and hollows, the keen spurrings and goadings to gain the top of the opposite hill, the headlong sled-like slide down its other side. All these, with the cries of the headsmen and harpooners, and the shuddering gasps of the oarsmen, with the wondrous sight of the ivory Pequod bearing down upon her boats with outstretched sails like a wild hen after her screaming brood. Soon we were running through a suffusing wide veil of mist, neither ship nor boat to be seen.
"Give way, men," whispered Starbuck, drawing still further aft the sheet of his sail. "There is time to kill a fish yet before the squall comes. There's a white water again. Close to! Spring!"
Soon after, Two cries in quick succession on each side of us denoted that the other boats had got fast. But hardly were they overheard when, with a lightning-like, hurtling whisper, Starbuck said, "Stand up!" And Queequeg, harpoon in hand, sprang to his feet. "That's his hump! There! There! Give it to him!" whispered Starbuck. A short, rushing sound leaped out of the boat. It was the darted iron of Queequeg. Then all in one welded commotion came an invisible push from astern, while forward the boat seemed striking on a ledge. The sail collapsed and exploded. A gush of scalding vapor shot up nearby. Something rolled and tumbled like an earthquake beneath us. The whole crew were half suffocated as they were tossed helter-skelter into the white curdling cream of the squall. Squall, whale, and harpoon had all blended together, and the whale, merely grazed by the iron, escaped. Though completely swamped, the boat was nearly unharmed. Swimming round it, we picked up the floating oars, and lashing them to the gunwale, tumbled back to our places. There we sat, up to our knees in the sea, the water covering every rib and plank, so that to our downward-gazing eyes the suspended craft seemed a coral boat grown up to us from the bottom of the ocean. The wind increased to a howl. The waves dashed their bucklers together. The whole squall roared, forked, and crackled around us like a white fire upon the prairie, in which, unconsumed, we were burning, immortal in these jaws of death. In vain we hailed the other boats. As well roar to the live coals down the chimney of a flaming furnace as hail those boats in that storm. Meanwhile, the driving scud, rack, and mist grew darker with the shadows of night. No sign of the ship could be seen. Wet, drenched through, and shivering cold, despairing of ship or boat, we lifted up our eyes as the dawn came on. The mist still spread over the sea. The empty lantern lay crushed in the bottom of the boat. Suddenly, Queequeg started to his feet, hollowing his hand to his ear. We all heard a faint creaking as of ropes and yards hitherto muffled by the storm. The sound came nearer and nearer. The thick mists were dimly parted by a huge, vague form. Affrighted, we all sprang into the sea as the ship at last loomed into view, bearing right down upon us within a distance of not much more than its length. Floating on the waves, we saw the abandoned boat. As for one instant, it tossed and gaped beneath the ship's bows like a chip at the base of a cataract. And then the vast hull rolled over it, and it was seen no more till it came up weltering astern. Again we swam for it, were dashed against it by the seas, and were at last taken up and safely landed on board. Ere the squall came close to, the other boats had cut loose from their fish and returned to the ship in good time. The ship had given us up, but was still cruising, if haply it might light upon some token of our perishing, an oar or a lance pole.